This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jenny, it's not that I don't love the song, because you know I love the song, but in all these episodes, I don't feel like I have anything new to add to my love of that song. I was realizing it today. I have nothing new to say about it.
We love it. It's the most beautiful song. Eli Braeden wrote a gem.
He wrote a gem. It's one for the ages. Thank you, Eli. And speaking of one for the ages, Jenny, did we luck out today? I mean...
I would say we lucked out today.
Holy shit.
I am for all ages, guys.
Yeah, she's suitable for ages five and up.
You wrote on Conan O'Brien, I would say, since the beginning of time.
Since the TBS show started.
Since the TBS show?
Yes.
You finalist on Last Comic Standing. You have a new album out called Corset.
Mm-hmm.
It's Lori Kill Martin, everybody. Give it up.
Shit, the crowd is going nuts.
Yeah.
Guys, calm down. Don't be a 45-minute show.
Guy's never been happier.
He's just smiling and happy.
He looks like he's just ready to rent you a sensible duplex in the middle of town. Just
We had Dan Cronin on the show, and he couldn't say nicer things about you. And
I love Cronin. I love
he's
Cronin.
He's so funny. And we're just like, we've been doing, you know, I think everybody, when Cronin announced that he was going off the air, there was sort of like I think we all just did a really deep dive. I mean, everybody I know in comedy was sort of like training, particularly from the TBS shows.
Yeah,
because
we've
already known the NBC stuff.
Yeah.
But like, I think there were like a lot of like really, there's so many hit, there's so many gems that are going to like out, that are going to outlive all of us online,
yeah.
from all of them, you know, Wiki Bear and all that shit that,
How many years was Conan, the TBS show? It was.
That was 10 and a half years, I think.
That's so crazy.
And then, I wrote some sketches, like I did Puppy Conan and stuff like that.
Yes.
But most of my stuff was monologue jokes, and they are not for the ages.
They have an expiration.
They're for like a day and a half, and then
you're canceled immediately.
They're just bad. Yeah,
I remember. Just a quick side note, because I try not to like tell stories over guest stories, but I was remodeling, and I found all these boxes. My first job writing for TV was for the old Arsenio Hall show, because I'm old.
Wow.
And I found these reams of jokes and like a notebook full. It's like, oh my God, I've uncovered gold. I'll be able to use these in other ways. And I just started reading through them, and it was like, how did I ever even have a job? But if you need some like really fire Dan Quayle burns, I am your man.
I remember, because I'm old too, when I first started doing stand-up, I was doing topical stuff, and I learned the lesson hard because I had a joke about, do you remember Jim Wright? He was the Speaker of the House.
Yes.
And he lied about something.
Yeah,
it was such a scandal that he had to resign. And I had a joke about it, and it killed for like 2 weeks, and then it went away. And I was like, never again. Never again. I'm only talking about my personal life. I'm never going to politics again.
It's really, it ages. Watch an old Murphy Brown and you'll just like, what?
Oh my God.
Or yeah. Don't watch an old Murphy Brown, by the way.
And everyone go watch old Murphy Browns like right now.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, so when did you start stand-up first? Did you start?
I started in 87 in San Francisco.
Oh my God.
And were you wanting to do stand-up or write or both or what was
I didn't, it didn't even dawn on me to be a writer. I just, I thought that was like a guy's thing. Like I didn't know any female writers and it just seemed like a different thing. And plus I was really into stand-up. It's such a club, you know, such a dirty art form and clubby. And I don't know, I felt like I was like a dirty person and And comedy writing seemed like Harvard types that would never go to a nightclub, you know. So I don't know. It didn't occur to me until till Colin Quinn started doing Tough Crowd, and uh-huh. and he hired a ton of club comics, and I was like, oh, I could do that. So that's how I got into late night writing, I guess. But before that, I was just a stand up, you know, always.
Are you from the Bay Area?
Yeah, I'm from Walnut Creek. I don't know if you know, it's the East Bay out there. Yeah.
And who is like in your class? Like they're like when you were coming up in that area, like who are the comics that were coming up?
Margaret Cho.
Oh, right.
Greg Behrendt.
Oh, of course.
You know, Blaine and Patton came out from Virginia, I think, at some point, a couple of years after we had started. Karen Anderson, who kind of began Ellen, you know, with Karen Kilgariff. Tony Kameen, who's still out here banging around. We're going to work together at the Punchline in April. We're like really old pals. So those are the comics that were pretty much my class. Ray James, I don't know if you know Ray James.
I don't.
He's a really dark comedy writer, but he's great. Yeah.
You just reminded me of Blaine. Did you read his like Twitter manifesto of like Rolling Stones top 500 albums of all time on Twitter?
I read some of it. I couldn't commit to it.
It's a long thing. I mean, I definitely skimmed around 300, but yeah. Holy cow, what an achievement to do all
yes.
that stuff.
Yes, so nice. Yeah, he's such a great joke writer. He uses only the words you need, it's Lake always so silly. You know, he's just great. Yeah,
he's a great follow too on Twitter. He never doesn't make me laugh.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Who were the people that like that you looked at like influences of comedy when you got into it? Like,
I had mostly negative influences of people I didn't like and thought I could be better than. But
I think that drives a lot of us. There's nothing unusual about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like Dana Carvey was huge in the Bay Area when I started. Like, he was about to go on SNL, so he was like working all the clubs. You know, and I just kept following him all around the Bay Area. This was before I started stand up, just at Rooster Teeth Feathers and at Foo Bars and the Punchline and the other cafe and stuff. And he was amazing, but I never thought, oh, I could do that because he was so good. But when I saw, you know, some of the comics opening for him, I was like, oh, wait, there's no way I'm worse than that guy. So that sort of opened the door for me. You know, seeing somebody that wasn't that good.
No, I agree. I mean, I was the most heartening thing ever because, like, when you like have a dream, I grew up in Jersey, but you have a dream of like, I want to do comedy, I want to write comedy. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to be up against the best of the best. And they're in. And surely you do meet people who are like, oh, I'll never be able to touch them. Yeah. But it's really heartening when you meet the people like, oh my God, I'm already better than they are.
Yeah.
And they have nice houses. I'm going to do great.
Yes. So yeah, that's kind of how I got going. And then I was sort of a road comic based out of the city, San Francisco, for like 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to New York and was there for about 10 or 11 years and then came out here, but I go back and forth all the time. I still have my place there and I go back at least once a month to do spots and stuff like that. So.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Was it hard when Conan ended? I mean, I was talking to it. To be on a show that long, I mean, I have some experience with this myself. And it really does feel like, you know, your family is going away. And
Yeah. I mean, plus I think we ended early because of COVID, you know, it just changed everything so quickly. And I think, you know, I wish, you know, in whatever early March when we had our last shows at Warner Brothers, I'd known, you know, like this is the
It'll
last
all
time
happen.
I'm gonna be in this meeting for the monologue meeting that we've done every day for 10 years that I have so much fun in with Andy and Conan and, you know, other various people just riffing. And this is the last time we're gonna follow Conan out while he goes over the jokes one last time and offer, you know, suggestions that he will bat away. You know, I mean, it was a ritual I really appreciated and loved. I didn't take it for granted because I'd worked on other shows, so I know it's not always fun. And so I always felt lucky that I got to be like part of it and a witness to it. And it was just so weird when the way that it just sort of ended. It didn't end the way something like that should end, in my opinion, you know.
No, I get it. We sort of, we ended right before COVID happened, and I, in a weird way, it sort of was this is a terrible thing to admit, but it was like I felt like, oh God, my show ended, and I was like bemoaning, and then it's like, oh, and then everybody, the world's show ended, and then it was
Yeah,
like, oh,
seriously.
okay, that's not so bad anymore. It's like, but yeah, I mean, at least we got that like we got the hugs in and the goodbyes and all
Yeah.
that.
I mean, we had kind of, you know, there was like a very tiny opportunity in June of this year in California where everything opened back up again. Like, I don't know if you remember, it's like, oh, we're back. You know, that's like that's a plus,
Doing
right?
live shows again, and you're like,
Yes.
holy
Yeah. And then so we got to end during like that 2 week opening, basically. So we did have some live shows at the very end, but you know, like I last December I went to, you know, we had pulled out of Warner Brothers offices, so we had to go in and, you know, get our stuff, you know, from our offices and, you know, get cleared, you know, people walking in one at a time and stuff like that. And so I went to my office, grabbed my stuff, and then I went down to the studio just to like take one last look, and it was demolished. I was like, what? It was so traumatizing. It was just pieces of wood everywhere, just like a bomb had dropped. And I couldn't even, like, you know, we had bathrooms and you know, dressing room and all that kind of stuff. Like, you could have just rolled that out and moved 10 homeless people into it, but they just destroyed it. It was really shocking to see.
It's horrible. It's like seeing people walk into your your childhood home. It's like I remember just seeing our sets come down. I was like, what? It was like there's a whole life here. I get it. It's hard.
So I was trying to figure out as I was walking amongst debris, like where's Conan's dressing room? Where's our walk to the mono spot? Where is it? I couldn't
Like a
even track it.
tornado had
All my
come through
landmarks
there.
were gone. Oh, what?
It's like when a tornado comes through and people are trying to
Yes.
sift through their shit. Like, where's my pictures and
Yeah,
my
even the grain silo's
albums?
down. I can't even figure out where what is north and south. Yes, exactly.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was
Well,
weird. That is.
speaking of Twitter, I kind of want to talk because you really like you probably know what I'm going to ask you about, but like when your mother was and it was dying, and you were live tweeting that. I think so many people, especially like I really was like I was gripped by that. I thought like that's like a good way to. I feel like that's you. I feel like you found like a good way for somebody who's funny and like to process grief. And I think it like I don't know. I found myself just checking in, and I talked to other people who don't know you, and like they had the same thing. Because this is like we all go through this, and like, what was that process like? Was that just was that spontaneous? Was it just like you're sitting there, and what else are you gonna do? I don't know.
I mean, I had done that with my dad when he had died of cancer in 2014. So I had already done it before. Like he just came home for hospice and I didn't want to leave the house because he was dying. So to do stand up, you know, like I was back in the Bay Area and there's, you know, a million open mics I could have gone to. And I usually just went out every night every time I was back in the Bay Area. And I was just writing jokes and I was like, oh, well, I'm not going to leave in case he dies, you know. So I just started tweeting jokes. And so that's sort of, I did that then. And then with my mom, I don't know, I was just, you know, there were, I mean, she was old, so obviously you knew at some point she was going to die. But the fact that it was COVID, I couldn't fucking believe it. I was like, are you serious? Like, we'd been so careful. And so I just started, I guess I just started doing that again, because it kind of felt natural for me. And also I at that time, I don't think there had been a lot of, you know, you knew what happened when someone died, but there hadn't been a lot of people saying, here's what happens as they're dying and stuff like that. Yeah. And my, our experience was different from other people, for sure. Cause my mom was unconscious really quickly. But the whole thing of like not being able to visit and, you know, just, I had my mom on the iPad, Huntington Hospital left her on for like 3 days straight, you know? So my sister and I, we just take my mom around the house and talk to her and, you know, I don't know if she heard, hopefully she heard, but it was so weird.
Did you ever get in to see her? Like, I remember you asking people to write the hospital, which I know a lot of us did actually, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it was, but it was like, because I know they relented it at a certain point, right?
They did. A lot of people, apparently I gave out the wrong email. That person got a lot of emails.
So I harassed the wrong doctor. Terrific.
I made that bomb threat for nothing is what.
Yeah.
I was wondering why a podiatrist was getting so involved in this.
And between that and my sister is a psychiatrist, so she belongs to a women physicians group on Facebook, and they all called the hospital too, or signed a letter or something. And so we got to see my mom for like an hour and a half on Monday, and then she died on Thursday. Oh, wow. So we got in right before she died, and you know, we talked to her and played, you know, played music and stuff. And she did she tried to sit up and she opened her eyes and rolled her eyes up. And that's the only movement I saw from the moment she was diagnosed with COVID. So I think she knew we were there, which is great. Yeah. And I hope she knew, I don't know if she knew she had COVID. I'm sure she did, but I wonder if she was worried that we were there, like she's trying to tell us to get out or something. Yeah. But we were head to toe and PPE and, you know, rubber gloves and stuff like that, and couldn't touch her skin. You know, just that I think back then it was still like, you know, we don't know and whatever.
No, I know. I mean, my first of all, if my dad had woken up to roll his eyes at me, I would have known he knew I was there. that's for sure. One of my twins was graduated with a nursing degree, and of course that was in 2020, and immediately went to the ICU down at Torrance Memorial. So she was and I was talking to her about it, and she was like, yeah, we were in the midst of that, like, how are we negotiating? People couldn't see their loved ones. It felt like horrible. So
How mentally draining on all the people that work there, because you know people are begging them, you know, with tears in their eyes, probably offered them money, please, anything, let me go.
Yeah, for sure.
Can't do it. Mm-hmm. When my dad died of cancer in 2012, and I actually did the same thing where I just started kind of posting tweets about it.
Yeah, right.
Just trying to make something funny. I would like get on the wet and dry board in his room and put like, show patient your tits. And then I would take a picture. And then they would like hide the wet and dry board, you know, marker from me and everything. But I was like, I don't know if I did it to help me or just to make light of the situation or whatever. But like, I did find, and I'm sure you did too, that people really responded and were like very appreciative of, you know, like making everyone else feel less alone when shit like that happens.
I know you put, like, I mean, we're friends, Jenny, but when you were doing that kind of stuff, it put me at ease in talking to you.
Oh yeah, it does, because with your friends, you're like, oh shit, I want to call her, but it's going to be depressing. Like,
yeah, I know.
You know, I find like, you can find the humor in everything. It's just how you do it.
You better.
You know?
Yeah, like
Did you ever have anybody like, you know, try to tweet at you like it was, you know, inappropriate or anything? Did you ever get people like that?
Nobody I knew, you know.
No, it's never people you know, but
yeah, so I didn't care.
Yeah, it would always be like, you're inappropriate, YOUR.
When I was doing my dad's death, I did get like nasty comments from two reporters from Al Jazeera.
Really?
Like, guys, you got bigger fish to fry. Don't worry about me.
Well, Al Jazeera has a page six, I guess. You know what I mean? Yeah.
You're like, it's very inappropriate. You're like, but really? But is it what I wrote? Like,
that's amazing. That's amazing.
Well, let me ask you about stand-up stuff and like Last Comic Standing. What
I want to hear
season
about this.
Were you on with that one?
I forget the number. I was on the season where the judges were Andy Kindler, Greg Giraldo, and Natasha Leggero, and the host was Craig Robinson. I think Felipe Esparza won, if I'm correct.
Oh.
And he might have narrowly beat out Tommy John again.
Oh, wow.
But how was that experience? Because I always like asking people their Last Comic Standing experience.
It was fine.
That's usually the response. Well, that spoke volumes.
That volume also just, you went up like two octaves. Like,
I turned into Mariah Carey. Every
right. It was fine.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I was cast, you know.
Yeah,
obviously, and it didn't hurt my career. It helped a little bit. So it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. Like, you know, I always feel like, and other comics have said this too. Like, when I get Montreal, it's the year after they stopped giving deals, right? Or right. You know, right. So I feel like when I'm in the top 10, it's when everyone stopped watching it. Or right. I don't know. I'm just a jinx or something. So
you didn't get the Dat fan bump, I guess.
I would love the Dat fan.
Isn't that just this common phrase that people use now, the Dat fan?
I mean, I think he was a very young comic, not yeah. just a young person, but like new to comedy. Yeah. But if that guy had, and I don't know, maybe he does, but if he had just taken a year and just hired writers and come out with a, like just a bang an hour, that would have been, he would have had an amazing career, you know?
Is that true? I don't know. He seems like a fun reference that like some of the funniest people I know bring up. So
the Dat fan.
Yeah, it was fine. It was cool. You know, it was Giraldo died the next year. So I was lucky to spend a little extra time with him, you know, before that happened. But
one of my favorites of all time.
Maybe like 1 or 2 years later. But I was, But, you know. It's also weird to get judged by fellow comics, and I would also have a hard time doing that, you know?
Oh my God.
Well, I always thought it was interesting because when I remember first hearing about the show, and I thought it was just going to be like complete, like open mic type comics. Like, and then I realized, oh, hell, I know all these, like who these comics are, you know, these are professional comedians. So did it make it like weird when you know, like somebody is already, you know, selling out and doing all these arenas or so, I mean, or like not arenas, but maybe theaters or like you have people that already have like an established fan base. Was that like,
well, I guess it just highlights the feeling of insecurity every comic has where, oh yeah, I sold out something yesterday, but I got nothing next week. You know, I mean, Joan Rivers, if you watch her documentary, she's obsessing about her calendar that she doesn't have enough shows. I'm like, of anyone that could just call a club and go, I'm going to be in town next week, like the whole week, bump whoever's there, it would be Joan Rivers.
And
that she didn't feel safe was really depressing to me and eye-opening as well.
I also think it's like
kind of relieving too in a way where you're like, oh, good, if you feel that way, then I'm not weird for feeling that way.
No, I'm not weird, but it's also like, wow, it never ends no matter how much success you have. Yeah. And if it never ends, this thing I think will end if I achieve X, Y, and Z. And this woman has achieved that, you know, 10 alphabets worth of achievements, and it's not over for her. Am I wrong too? Yeah. You know, she obviously thought it would be over at some point. And she must have lived her whole life that way because she died shortly after that. So she must have lived her whole life going, I don't have enough shows lined up.
What's the next thing?
I do find that reassuring too, Jenny. Like, I agree with you. Like, when people who are like wildly successful are still stressing, it's like, oh, good. I'm not like I want it to end, but then again, it makes me feel like, well, if they can stress out, I'm certainly entitled to stressing out.
Well, I remember the first time I sold a pitch and I was like about to send in my first draft, and I asked you, Danny. I was like, I'm like shaking.
That's, just I remember this.
And I was like, I can't do it. This is, I'm going to hit send. And then they're going to go, what the fuck were we thinking? Why did we hire this girl to write, you know, like write this pilot? And I asked Danny and he goes, every single time I send in a script, I'm just sweating bullets. Like this, right. Like, okay, that makes me feel really better. But then also like,
I still,
this feeling never goes away. Fun.
Yeah, it never goes away. You know, it also never goes away.
What is it, Danny?
Capitalism, commerce. You know, it's like, you know, and for better or worse, it's the system we got. And fortunately, you know, you can do, you can want to do things, you know, you can fight it and you're going to lose, or you can try and like team yourself up with some amazing sponsors like these coming up right now. Holy what? Shit. And the Emmy for best segue goes to we'll be right back. Doing it, Nation.
All right, Doing It Nation. BetOnline remains your number one source for all your sports betting for football and basketball this season. You'll always find the latest odds, team matchup info, player news, and game trends at BetOnline. Always your continued source for sports wagering information. BetOnline features live betting, free contests, live scores for almost any sport or game imaginable. We're the fastest and easiest way to bet all your favorite NFL, NBA, NHL, MMA, tennis, boxing, and even golf games and events. Head to betonline.ag to join and receive your 50% welcome bonus with your first deposit. Make sure to use promo code CLNS50. That is CLNS50 to receive your rewards. BetOnline, where the game starts.
And we're back, and oh my God, how about our sponsors?
Holy shit. I'm gonna buy or use or apply all of those products.
I will buy or shoplift whatever was just said.
Yes, you absolutely will. One thing we did, Lori, during this, we did a few Zoom comedy shows.
Yes.
Together.
Right. Well,
now, did you feel like a webcam girl after a while? Like I did.
No, because they make money. So no.
But what, like, how did that feel to, like, I just treated it, I just started kind of storytelling and trying to make it as less awkward as I could. What was, you know, your experience?
I think like early on, did you feel like it was kind of fun because we were trying and the audience was trying and we were all stuck at home and
yes.
For a little while, we were all sort of on the same page in quarantine before the vaccine drove us apart.
We just went.
Unbelievable. But I mean, it's good enough to, like, I worked out some material for sure. Yeah. It doesn't replicate, you know, actually being in front of somebody. I mean, part of what's exciting about stand-up to me is the potential discomfort of the audience and myself. And that keeps them on the edge of their seats a little bit. And something about all that going on in the air kind of helps you be funnier.
Yeah. And I fully know what you mean. Cause I remember like April, you know, April, 2020 or something. Flappers, and shout out to Flappers. They put a lot of those Zoom comedy shows on. And you're right. Like everyone, I mean, I would look out and everyone was like fresh face, you know, like you'd see some couple splitting a bottle of wine. They're like really enthusiastic. Yeah. And then a year later, I remember looking out, there was a guy with no shirt on. It's like, so this is where we're
at. Danny, what were you doing there?
He was just trying to hype
it. It was pants. It felt like you really did have to adjust how you did stand up. I suppose I didn't do any of it. I never did a Zoom. I mean, I did like a speaking thing, or I did but the idea of like doing stand up, the ones who were really like launching into just pure material, it just seemed to always, like even good comics, it would fall flat. And the ones who I knew who were doing a really good job were just sort of having a discussion. You know.
So. Yeah, I did one that was, it wasn't through Flappers. I won't say who it was through, but I just remember like the guy producing it, and there was a lot of people in the audience. I'm like, oh great, like 100 people. And then I hear right before it starts, okay, we want everyone to please mute yourself so the comics can hear the, you know, themselves. And I'm like, perfect.
No.
So dead silence. That's
That started happening a lot because people at first weren't muting themselves, so every noise was coming through, so they right. would be embarrassed, and then everyone muted themselves.
Right. Being told, everyone, please mute yourself. I'm like, oh, fantastic.
So wrong.
This is going to really make me feel good about
this. Oh my God. Well, I want to hear, before we talk about the stuff that we've been watching, which is it's a key component of the show that people seem to go nuts for. I mean,
yeah, they love it.
They're
love
thirsty it. For it. But I want to hear about the album. Tell me how that came about, where you recorded, let's promote the fuck out of this thing.
Let's promote it. It's number 3 on iTunes right now.
Holy shit.
Hold on. It was number 1 for a day. And then okay. Bo Burnham, that alpha, clawed his way back on top. Oh, right.
Dick.
And then I was trading. So I've been trading places with Ninja Sex Party, which is a comedy.
Ninja Sex Party?
Your nemesis, Ninja Sex Party.
And then at one point I was just ahead of, and I love that this person exists, a comedic musician called Wendy Ho. Her headshot is she's sitting on a toilet, and her album is called Greatest Shits. So she and I are head to head.
Well, you must run into her auditions all the time.
She's one step ahead of you, that damn window.
So it's been fun to watch that. And now all the rest of like the top 15 or 20 are a lot of old albums, like Dane Cook, Harmful of Swallowed and stuff. And it feels like the people that are buying albums are like 48-year-old white men who want to download the thing they loved when they were 20. You know, it's a lot of old stuff. It's weird. Weird Al, let some old Weird Al. Like people that are currently making albums, but they're early stuff. So strange. Let's see. I recorded it in November of 2020 at the San Francisco Punchline.
Oh, fun.
October. And then I don't know if you're like this way as well, Jenny, couldn't listen to the sound of my voice for a year and a half. Uh-huh. Could not sit down and actually pick cuts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then I don't know, I guess I finally got through it, and 800 pound gorilla put it out, and that's that, I guess.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's how long has it been out? We got like what we're number two on iTunes?
2 weeks.
Holy cow, we gotta get this. And sure. Name one more time for everybody.
It's called Corset, and I called it that because at the time I recorded it, it kind of covered material written from the last 5 years, which I had spent living with an 8 to 12 year old boy as he grew, and a 78 to 82 year old mother. And so I felt like I was being squeezed so tightly I couldn't breathe. And so I decided that's what it feels like to be in a corset. And so that's why I named it that. But there's like a lot of material about me, you know, wanting my mom to die. And guys, my dream came true. That's a good part.
So do it at Nation, you know, just
you believe. And your heart is pure. Dreams will come true.
She was a lot. She was a lot. But, you know, so, it covers a lot of that kind of stuff. And I have a very dark sense of humor. And so, you know.
Which is why I'm such a big fan.
Thank you.
Now, is this your son or is this your son or just somebody you picked up on the street?
It is my son.
Okay, good. Very clear. So, yeah, that's good. How old is he now?
He's 15 now.
Oh, yeah. My God. That's a good age, right?
It's a great age. And it's so weird. I mean, I don't know if are your kids younger, Danny? Are they?
No, my youngest is going to be 21 in December.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like the kids that were in quarantine, like during these tween years, they are like 2 years younger biologically than they think they are. Because my kid missed eighth grade, which is the most toxic grade in America.
Of course.
Half of seventh. So he's like still sort of kind of bouncy and happy. And he's not a brooding teenager freshman in high school like I thought he would be, you know, and his friends are sort of dorky in that same way.
Well, that's, I mean, it definitely took a toll. I mean, it was one of the, I mean, I thank God, as hard as it, you know, was for everything, you know, one of my daughters finished college or like just the last semester at home. And my son, you know, was a sophomore, I guess, at UCLA. But it's so different when you're like, David, you know, that separation. Also, I had no responsibility for educating my college age children.
Right. Like,
you had to be there and like, are they going to do, you know, that's hard.
Oh, I'm not there for him at all.
Oh, good to hear. That makes me feel so much better.
He's a C/D student. No, I did say you can't get D's. I feel like kids are who they are. And so for me to like, you know, be really strict on an artistic kid who hates school, it's, I don't want to make him miserable. And, you know, I know other people that their kids were born straight A students, you know, and they like it. And I just have a different kid. So I just, my motto is just keep it a C. Please keep it above a C. Yeah. I know you can do that.
Wow, quite the tiger mom over here. Calm down. No, I had three. And so I got to the youngest, my son actually turned out to be like the straight A guy.
Yeah.
And it's like, so I, it was like, okay, cool. I finally got one because my daughters were idiots. They're fine.
And now one of them's an ICU nurse.
Yeah, no, she actually, she's fine. You're in great hands.
But I can't stop thinking about it, actually, that he, half of seventh grade and all of eighth grade was missed.
Yeah.
Like those are puberty, like the full on puberty, like
slow dances with girl, all that kind of stuff.
All the nightmare years. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I remember I didn't start my period till I was like a month before I was 16. I was like a super late bloomer. Wow. So eighth grade, I was like, sweet. I got the body of a 12-year-old boy. Get this dance. Like all the emotional trauma that comes with it. At least he missed out on that.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad he did. Yeah. So
he's like blissfully ignorant to all the mean things that could have happened.
Well, okay, so let's get to it. Let's get to the much advertised thing. Lori, what are the things you've been watching that you want to recommend or like or hate watching or things like that?
Let's see. I watch a lot of anime with my kid. I started doing that during the pandemic. So
which ones?
I've already watched it twice and I was just up with my sister. So I was trying to get her kids into it. It's called Attack on Titan.
Both of my daughters love that.
It's incredible. Have you watched it?
No, I got to watch. I heard it's amazing.
It's incredible. And you know, season one and two, we got your protagonist. And then season three, they switch the whole thing around and they start with the people that you hated. And by the end of it, you're like, I love all of them. It's incredible. How they pivot your point of view. You know,
I'm literally going to call her after this because she's trying to get me watching, and I would tell her about it.
It's great. And then, so I'm just going to the end of this. The final season's coming out pretty soon. I forget when. So, but I recommend watching the whole thing, obviously. And then we just started this anime called The 86, and it's about this group of there's a kingdom of pure white people with gray hair, silver hair, and they have they have another group of people called the 86 who are dirty, right? And they're kicked out of the kingdom, but the 86 are sent to fight people, another country that's attacking the pure country, I guess. And a woman inside the 86 is a commander of the 86. And I think I'm explaining this really poorly.
No, I'm getting it.
Because I'm actually confused with what I'm saying. But it's so good. And there's like these, I don't know if this is right or wrong, but it seems like a lot of Japanese anime has allusions to World War II and Attack on Titan, especially with atomic bombs. You know, you're like, oh yeah, see how this reverberated in the culture for generations. Yeah,
the way we go on about 9/11, they had a nuclear attack that we caused. It feels fair.
We go on about that.
Yeah, I am doing a terrible job explaining the 86, but it's really good. And if you start it now, you're not going to be too far behind. You're not going to have more than a season and a quarter to catch up.
I'm going to ask her about that too. I'm going to watch that together too. That'll leave. Anything else, or is that good?
And then, you know, Succession, of course.
That's where I was going to go to next. Yeah. But before I go to that, I watched with my daughter, one of my favorite anime series was this It's only, I think, I don't know if they're like 13 or 15 episodes, maybe 20, of a show called Paranoia Agent.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Oh my God. It is so trippy. It has to deal with like mass delusion. Like there's this like somebody who's attacking in Tokyo called Shojin Bat, and he's like this kid on skateboard and like bats people, but is it a delusion? And everybody seems to be having it, and it's just, it's so trippy. It was by the guy, his name I'm forgetting, who directed that movie Paprika and another anime which is fantastic, and Perfect Blue. So I'm like, I'm gonna watch your recommendations. Succession has been so good though. I don't want to spoil it, but holy shit, I have enjoyed. I can't wait for it. And last week was, are you caught up? It's so.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
It's just been so amazing.
It's so good. It's so fun to have something to look forward to, like a show every week.
Yeah.
You know, like we're like so binge watch spoiled and everything. It's like fun to actually wait and go, oh, a new episode's dropped.
Yeah. And to have to jump off Twitter because the Succession is weighing in.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
I don't want any spoiler alerts.
You know what I've noticed is Shiv, the character of Shiv, is obviously she's American, but she uses a lot of British sayings and phrasing. And I'm wondering, like, are they, you know, because obviously it's written by a British guy.
Yeah,
but there's a ton of Americans on it too. So I just wonder why no one's stopping her. Or I guess the character's written that way, and no one's saying, "Hey, I don't know that an American would phrase it that way."
Because I've had the same thought, and she's Australian, I think.
Yeah.
But it's written by Brits, and lot of that stuff. It's sort of like for me, because I've heard this pointed out too, and I noticed it. But I think because you think of them as so patrician, that maybe it like in that. I don't know.
Maybe they were like sent off to school or something.
I don't know, but it's
maybe.
And maybe they picked up on.
Maybe that sort of Madonna hybrid.
Oh God.
But they'll say yeah at the end of a sentence.
I know.
Right. Which I'm like, that is so British. It's such a tick that I they must know they're doing it and it doesn't sound exactly right to American ears, but they don't care or something.
Right.
I don't know.
No, I love it. That show is so great.
Yeah.
What about you, Jen?
I just finished What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh my God.
Love it. Colin Robinson. Loved it.
It's have you watched it yet, Lori?
No, I haven't.
I'm telling you, it is without a doubt the best comedy on TV right now.
I've heard. Yeah, it's on my list. Dope Sick. I'm about halfway through.
How is that? I really want to see that.
It's really good. It's really, really good. You know, it's a good, I guess, companion piece to the documentary.
Crime of the Century.
Yes. Yeah. Where, you know, and Michael Keaton plays a, like an Appalachian based doctor.
Yeah.
I'm in.
He goes through an incredible arc and he's so good. It's really good. And it, you know, again, like you just can't believe this was allowed to happen.
I know.
It's like you can and you can't. There's a part of me that goes, yeah, I can see. Yeah.
And it's so, because like people are, you know, there's the anti-vax crew is so distrustful of the government. And then you watch this and you're like, well, yeah, I mean, the FDA kind of allowed this thing to happen. So I get it. But then they're like, well, we'll take the vaccine if it's FDA approved. But wait, I don't know. It's also, nothing is a straight line anymore. You know, it's weird.
It's wild.
It's upsetting because then you go like, well, who do you trust then?
Yeah.
Are we just untrustworthy of everyone? Like at some point, where do you draw the line?
Yeah.
I know. It's a messed up world. That's, and by the way, that's the theme of today's episode. It's a messed up world. Well, Lori, I mean, what can I say that hasn't been said in this podcast already?
Well, thank you for having me. What a delightful duo you are. Dynamic, I might add.
Sometimes, you know, we're always thrilled at our guests, but sometimes it's a genuine thrill, and we're genuinely thrilled that you were here today.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you for asking.
Very excited to have you on. And we will make sure to add the link to your special.
Oh, cool. Right on.
On the side, is there anything else you want to plug?
I wrote a book called Dead People Suck. It's about... It's about my dad dying of cancer. It's comedy about hospice and cancer and grief and stuff like that. If anyone is into that, otherwise, just talk on the old album.
I will fully read that because
and we're going to link to that as well.
Like cancer, hospice?
Heck yeah!
Oh yeah, our dad's died of cancer. Whatevs.
Dead dad crew.
Yeah. Rolling again.
But thank you, Doing It Nation, again for joining us. I mean, who knows? Can't promise we're going to top to this week's guest, but we're going to try our damn hardest next week.
Thank you, Lori Kilmartin. Thank you, Doing It Nation.
Thank you.